We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
Last year, America's oil production reached its highest level since 2003, but I believe that we should continue to expand oil production in America.
That's President Obama from his weekly Saturday morning address. The president has now ordered the Interior Department to speed up oil and natural gas drilling in the United States. For more on that story and others we're following, we're joined by our friend James Fallows of The Atlantic. Jim, good to have you here.
Hello, Guy.
I want to start with the president's announcement today. Gas prices are averaging $4 a gallon. Republicans accuse him of not tapping into domestic sources of oil and gas, so he has ordered the Interior Department to go ahead and speed up this process. Is this why he's doing it now? Is this political pressure?
Sure. This has to be a political move just because, by definition, it would be years and years before these new leases could have any effect on the energy supply. And strictly as politics, you have to say this is preferable to the response during the previous gas price spike during the 2008 campaign, where several of the candidates, not Obama, said that the answer was to have a gas tax holiday.
Right.
But I think that the real political answer here in the deepest sense is a reminder of how dealing with energy problems is an all-front effort. There is no cheap or easy or consequence-free source of energy in the long run. Nuclear has its problems. Renewables are expensive. So this is one more reminder of that fact.
Later in that speech, which, of course, anyone can read online, the president went after the oil companies. He's done this before. It's a populist move. He's basically saying they get a $4 billion tax break, and Congress is supposed to be voting on ending those tax breaks next week. That doesn't seem likely. So I guess this is all part of that whole thing.
Sure. And if you think if there's any industry which at the moment seems the least deserving or sympathetic candidate for tax breaks, it would be the oil and gas companies right now.
Jim, I want to go in a different direction because, as you know, this week, just as news came out that the president plans to address the thorny topic of the Middle East, his top envoy to the Palestinians and Israelis, George Mitchell, quit. And most people say out of frustration.
And that would certainly be a reasonable response by former Senator Mitchell. Certainly the omens look unpromising for the next couple of years because of domestic politics within Israel, especially about settlements and about the recent developments on the Palestinian side, especially statements by Hamas. I think also a reflection here is some of the limits of what you could think of as the super negotiator model that many presidents have applied over the years. Senator Mitchell actually did this successfully under President Clinton when he brought together the Northern Ireland factions, and the late Richard Holbrooke had done it during the Dayton Peace Accords. But often in American history, this model has led to some disappointment. I think Senator Mitchell is seeing that now.
Finally, Jim, Facebook versus Google. It seems that Facebook, which is a company that talks a lot about transparency, has done something pretty underhanded. They apparently hired a prominent PR firm to anonymously encourage reporters to write nasty things about its rival Google. What do you make of that?
I think this is bad. It's bad for Facebook. It's bad for Burson Marsteller, the PR company. You know, every big company has its problems, and Google itself has all sorts of lawsuits all around the world. But I have a constructive suggestion here. Google has used its motto, "Don't be evil," and it's often been criticized for not living up to that model. I think the new motto for Facebook could be less evil.
Okay, maybe they'll take you up on it. That's The Atlantic's national correspondent, James Fallows. He joins us here on this program most Saturdays. Jim, thanks.
Thank you, Guy.
Budget crunches are hitting cities hard, too. And so cash-strapped cities and towns are cracking down on those who don't pay taxes, even those who don't have to. Universities, hospitals, and museums, which are all tax-exempt, are now being pressed to pay millions of dollars to help support city services. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports now, Boston has just launched one of the most aggressive efforts in the country.
From the nation's founding, those doing the Lord's work, healing the sick, or educating the masses have all been given a pass on paying taxes. The thinking has been we owe them more than they owe us. But in these hard financial times, that thinking is changing.
I think we've reached a point where something needs to give here.
Boston's assessing commissioner Ron Rocco says no one wants to be an ungracious host. Boston wouldn't be Boston, he says, without its many world-renowned universities and hospitals. But Rocco says those institutions benefit like everyone else, from city police or snowplows, for example, and they need to help pay for it.
We are glad that they are part of our city, but we can no longer afford to give 100% tax subsidy to these institutions when, you know, they are such a big portion of our city.
Many nonprofits have been volunteering for years to make payments in lieu of taxes, but Boston's no longer willing to just take what it gets, and it's now sending out pseudo-tax bills asking nonprofits for 25% of the usual rate. The city says institutions can pay half in kind with scholarships or free care. Ultimately, Boston can't force nonprofits to pay, but Rocco says he will be posting who does and who doesn't.
The ones that maybe aren't doing as much as some of the others, it certainly is going to put them in a place where they're going to need to explain to the public why.
Not surprisingly, the so-called guidelines for giving aren't playing so well among some nonprofits.
I think when you come up with a formula that is a percentage of assessed value, that simply looks too much like a tax.
Richard Doherty is with the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities in Massachusetts.
The tax exemption is not a loophole. It's a very deliberate public policy that recognizes that if it weren't for these private not-for-profit entities, government would be forced to be providing higher education and health care, and that cost would be absolutely staggering.
Doherty says many nonprofits are already giving the city as much as they can, and some of the top givers are balking at the demand for more. Rich Kopp is a spokesman for Partners Healthcare, which owns Massachusetts General Hospital.
I would say that before we consider increasing the size of our contribution, we are hoping that others reconsider their level of contribution to be more consistent and fair.
One admitted undergiver, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, has been asked to increase from $170,000 to nearly $3 million. CEO Eric Burns says it will.
You never like to get a letter from the tax commissioner, but we thought that it was inevitable that the city was going to have to seek some recalibration of the contribution that these institutions are making to the tax base.
Around the nation, other cities like Providence and Pittsburgh have also been putting the squeeze on nonprofits. But Penn State professor Donald Heller says cracking down on schools and hospitals is unlikely to prompt a groundswell of public support.
I think people tend to be saying, look, if there's anybody abusing the system, it's not the public charities out there. It's the corporations that are getting away with not paying any taxes. And that's where we ought to be looking, not at trying to wring a few million dollars out of the universities in Boston or Cambridge.
But to some, the line has blurred between universities and corporations. Boston City Council President Stephen Murphy says many are now sophisticated financial giants, for example, staging big-name rock concerts in their tax-exempt sports arenas.
And really, they're using the tax-exempt purpose of medicine or education to get around the fact that they're on a huge land grab here. And, you know, at some point in time, you got to say, hey, man up.
If the cities don't say it, in some cases, the taxpayers will, like in New Jersey, where angry residents filed suit accusing Princeton University of, quote, not paying its fair share. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time magazine has called Bill James one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Quite a billing for someone who was working as a night watchman at a pork and beans factory in the 1970s when he began to write about baseball. Bill James envisioned new statistics like runs created rather than runs, hits, and errors, and his baseball abstract changed baseball more powerfully than any invention since the leather glove. He's currently a senior advisor to the Boston Red Sox. Bill James is also a passionate reader, especially of crime stories, and he's written a new huge book that presents his particular glimpses into famous crime stories. It's called Popular Crime, Reflections on the Celebration of Violence. Bill James joins us from member station KANU in Lawrence, Kansas. Mr. James, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Mr. Simon.
You say at several points in this book, look, I'm not a criminologist, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a psychologist. So what is it when it comes to you and crime?
I'm not an expert in anything that's established. 99% of my book is based on writing about other writers, writing about crimes. Hmm.
Series of murders were committed in Boston in the early 1960s. Murders of 13 single women from the age of 19, I guess, into their 70s, were lumped under the title the Boston Strangler. A man named Albert DeSalvo confessed to being the Boston Strangler. That became a famous film starring Tony Curtis. Was, in your judgment, Albert DeSalvo the Boston Strangler?
Well, the hero of that story is a Boston woman named Susan Kelly, who wrote a book which convinced me, and I adopted her point of view and advocated it with some of my own interpretation. Her point of view is basically no evidence that Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler, and it's very improbable that he was.
He did confess.
Yes. And about a month before he confessed, a psychiatrist who knew him very well testified under oath that he was delusional and incompetent to stand trial.
But, I mean, a lot of people listening to this are wondering, but to restate the obvious, he confessed. I mean, why would someone who wasn't guilty of a string of murders confess?
There are, I believe, many more false confessions to murders than true confessions. In fact, if I could freelance for just a second, I would be in favor of laws strictly limiting what can be described as a confession in a courtroom, because what happens in too many cases is the police know how to get somebody to confess to something. They know how to make that happen, and they will make it happen, and they get a sort of half confession, which the prosecutor then describes relentlessly as a confession, when in reality it was just something like, yeah, I guess she must be dead by now. The problem of false confessions is one of the nastiest problems that besets a serious murder trial.
Sam Shepard, Dr. Sam Shepard, famous 1954 Cleveland murder case, doctor accused of murdering his wife, Marilyn, famously the inspiration for the Fugitive TV series and movie. The Shepard case is considered to be the one that established the idea that excessive press coverage could twist justice in a case. Do you agree?
The Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court used the Shepard case to say that the courts had a responsibility to make the case stand free of flying journalistic debris. It's extremely damaging to a fair trial to have people reaching judgment about the case in the newspapers and on the radios before the facts are heard in case. I would not encourage anybody to think we've gotten past that. The reality is that we still have that issue, and we still have it as much or more than we did in 1966.
Mr. James, who killed JonBenet Ramsey?
We don't know yet. We will know. They have his DNA. Logic tells you if they find his DNA that it's a process of elimination to eventually find him.
Not her parents in any case.
Absolutely not her parents. And it's a horrible thing what happened to her parents, that within weeks of losing their daughter in the hardest way one can imagine, they became the butt of jokes by late-night television comedians. This happened essentially because the local authorities, trying to reduce the pressure on themselves, led the news media to a premature conclusion that they were involved in the crime, which in truth they very clearly were not.
You think the disdain that some smart and informed people have for crime stories actually might have a harmful effect on how we handle it in our society?
Crime stories have a huge ugh factor, and because people don't want to talk about those kind of things, we will very often find that the discussion turns off at a point at which it should be asking the most interesting question. So what I was trying to get to in the book was, let's push on past the ugh factor.
Bill James, Man Who Changed the Way We See Baseball, author of a new book, Popular Crime, Reflections on the Celebration of Violence. Thanks so much, Mr. James.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt about a London girl's account of her 18th century kidnapping on our website, npr.org. Tonight, TLC airs a documentary, Off the Res. It's a coming-of-age story, a drama about generations. Sports, sweat, winning, losing, sacrifice, triumph, and love. Boy, that's a lot in 86 minutes. Jonathan Hawke's film follows the rise of a high school basketball star named Shoni Schimmel. Her mother, Cecily Moses, is also her coach. But they move off the Umatilla Indian Reservation in eastern Oregon and go to Portland to maximize Shoni's chances of success at a new school. Now, at one point, her team, the Franklin High School Quakers, fall behind in the first half of a big game. Coach Moses tells the team, including her daughter, this.
You guys have to want this. You dig down deep and you go hard and you take it away from them. You take it away from all those people that don't want you to have it. Believe, you guys. Believe. One, two, three. Believe!
Shoni Schimmel has just finished her freshman year at the University of Louisville. Her mother, Cecily Moses, still coaches at Franklin. They both join us from Palatine Recordings in Portland, Oregon. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cecily Moses, when did you first see your daughter Shoni pick up a basketball?
Well, she started playing basketball when she was about 4 years old. And that's when she had her first basketball tournament. And I kind of, that was the moment.
Basketball tournament when she's four?
Yes. Back on the reservation, they had an age bracket was 4 to 6. And wow. that year, Shoni went in there and we put her in her first tournament. And that's the first time I knew something, this girl was gifted, because they went in and they went to the championship and they stomped on Shoni. I mean, they didn't beat him bad, but they beat her. And for her, that was so devastating. And I'm not kidding you. Ever since then, I've seen that fire in that girl's eyes. And that girl played a phenomenal game, you know, only at 4 years old. And she lost, but I'm not kidding you. Ever since then, she's had that drive to just become better.
Shoni Schimmel, what do you love about basketball?
Just being able to be out there and playing basketball. I couldn't really describe it. Just having the ball in my hand, being able just to go out there and have fun, just play with my other teammates like Sam and whatnot. I just love playing basketball.
Why did you think it was necessary, Cecily Moses, for you and Shoni and her younger sister, also a great basketball player, Jude, to move off the res and go to Portland?
I personally felt like it was not just a move for just me to prove that I could coach, but it was also a move where I could teach not just my kids, but other Native Americans that are doing the right things to get where they want to get, mm-hmm. that, you know what, you can live your dreams and you can have dreams and you can pursue your dreams.
Shoni Schimmel, you are, well, you're becoming a very well-known athlete. Do you feel pressure to succeed, not just for you, but for your family, and if I might even put it this way, for your people?
I wouldn't say I feel the pressure. I know it's there, but I don't let it get to me. I mean, I'm just playing basketball and going to school like a normal kid, really. I mean, just all the other stuff comes with it. So I'm just trying to be a role model and do what I do best, really, is just play basketball and be a positive person out there, especially for the Native American people, just because not many Native Americans get the opportunity that I've been blessed with ever since I was a young kid, just because my parents helped me open the doors and I just had to basically get through them, really. And so, I mean, doing what I love doesn't really come with pressure, just going out there and playing basketball.
May I point out, most normal kids don't wind up on the freshman All-America team as you have. Do you even know, by the way, how many points you averaged every game?
This season?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Well, 16. You're great. and almost 6 assists per game. You're very good.
Thank you. Thank you.
So what's it like to be coach and mother?
Being coach and mother, it's really fun. I always talk to my kids about everything practically in life. And when it came to coaching and being the parent, you know, I would just flip it and say, you know, here's the deal. This is a job. We're going to be professional. I'm the coach. You're the player. If you want to become unprofessional and turn into the son or the daughter role, then the mother comes out, and that's not pretty. So you choose.
Coach.
Yes, yes. So I would basically put it in their hands, my kids' hands, to basically keep it professional.
You're sending 2 daughters back to Louisville come the fall. Jude is going to join Shoni.
Yes, she is.
Schimmel sisters might leave quite an impact on women's college basketball before they're done.
That would be nice. I hope, you know, honestly, of course we don't think of it that way, but I hope not just, you know, for Shoni and Jude to experience that, but I hope they get that opportunity, because I think it'll do a world of good to other Native Americans on the reservation.
Yeah. Shoni Schimmel, what's it like to have a sister on the team?
It's awesome. I mean, me and Jude have been playing together since her 3rd grade year and my 5th grade year. So having that right-hand man always there for you, to always have your back, to always catch your passes, to always make that extra shot that you need and that you can't make, that she's there for. I mean, she's my right-hand man. She's my go-to person every time on the court. If I can't do something, I know she'll get it done and I'll have her back just like she had mine.
Shoni Schimmel just finished her freshman year at University of Louisville. Her mother, Cecily Moses, the women's basketball coach at Franklin High School in Portland, Oregon. A film about their family, Off the Res, airs on TLC tonight. Thank you both very much for being with us.
And thank you for asking us to talk.
Thank you for having us.
And you can watch Shoni Schimmel in action. We got clips from that documentary on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's time for sports. The mighty names are dropping. The NBA Eastern Conference Finals are set. One more game to decide the Western Finals. None of the teams are called Lakers, Celtics, or Spurs. Our Tom Goldman joins us. Morning, Tom.
Good morning, Scott. I want you to know this continues to be the highlight of my Saturday mornings at 40 minutes past the hour.
Well, it'll be over soon. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Memphis, come Oklahoma City or high water, forced to game seven against Oklahoma City. Who's got the edge tomorrow?
Oh, I don't know. What do you think? I think Oklahoma City probably because, you know, they're going to be playing it on their home court and everyone's going to be dressed in white, and including the fans. And I just think, you know, they're such an offensively explosive team. Memphis has done very well to keep this series alive. But I think in a game seven, this is when the home court advantage really makes a difference.
Yeah. And particularly that arena, although it'll be great if either of those teams got into the finals. But let me ask, Dallas, of course, has about a 45-day layoff after sweeping the Lakers, which brings up that old question. Does this give them time? And they're an older team, the Mavs, despite that name. Does it give them time to recuperate or just get rusty? And if you say time will tell, I'm going to be very cross.
Okay, then go on to the next question. No, they got lots of time. You know, they're just trying to stay busy. They're trying to scrimmage as much as they can. It does help an older team like this, and they're going to need that because whoever they face, Memphis or Oklahoma City, they're going to have to be very. They're going to face a very speedy team, especially at the point guard position. So a guy like Jason Kidd, that old man at 38 for the Dallas Mavericks, he's going to have to move his feet a lot. The Mavs have been up to the task defensively so far in the playoffs. They've allowed a little over 88 points a game. That's the best among remaining teams. But they'll have a challenge. Mm.
And, of course, the Bulls and the Miami Heat, Chicago Bulls and Miami Heat. You've got that James Wade Bosch triumvirate of billionaires. The Bulls have Derrick Rose and some good supporting names. Any chance?
Yeah, there's a chance. They've got the home court advantage. They've got a great defense. They have the league MVP, as you say, Derrick Rose. They beat the Heat three times during the regular season, and I think, you know, people always discount the regular season when the playoffs come. The most important stat from those three wins, Scott, was that Chicago out-rebounded Miami by a total of 32 rebounds in three games. If Chicago can do that effectively versus the Heat, especially offensive rebounds, which would give the Bulls multiple chances to score, they don't have to worry about that question everyone's asking after Derrick Rose, who's Chicago's go-to guy offensively. Yeah. They could have a chance that way.
I think the Heat believe if they don't get the rebound, they'll just buy another ball. we have a couple of very sad deaths to report this weekend. Dallas Cowboys running back Ron Springs died on Thursday. And on Friday, we awake to the news this morning. New York Rangers left winger Derek Bougard was found dead in his apartment. He was just 28.
28 years old. You know, always shocking when an athlete who appears to be in good health dies suddenly like that. Derek Bougard, known as the boogeyman in the league, he's a left wing for the New York Rangers. Best known as a fighter. Got a lot of penalty minutes during his career. But those who knew Derek said he was a very kind and caring guy. Despite his brawler reputation, he was very involved with military-related charities.
Yeah. Well, and they'll be looking for the concussion information, I'm sure.
Right, because he sat out a bunch of games, 52 games of this last season with a serious concussion.
NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome.